Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Candace Millard has a thing for long-dead presidents. The best-selling author from Leawood focused her last book on Theodore Roosevelt and his death-defying journey down the River of Doubt in South America. Her newest book focuses on James Garfield and his assassination in 1881. This story's got everything. A president who didn't set out to be president, a deranged man stalking him, misguided doctors treating the president so poorly that they, more so than the assassin's bullets, killed the president, a nation unhinged, the great inventor Alexander Graham Bell racing against time to save Garfield. And then there's the ultimate tragedy here, the loss to the nation of an extraordinary man respected by both North and South. Candace Millard's new book is Destiny of the Republic, a tale of madness, medicine, and the murder of a president. And it's so good to have her back here again. Candace,
so good
morning.
To be here. Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Now, how did you get interested in a president, Candace, who no one really knows anything about and who's been dead for 130 years?
Well, to be honest, I didn't know much about him either beyond the fact
that he'd
been assassinated precisely. And I wasn't necessarily interested in writing about another president. I was interested in science. I always have been. And I was researching Alexander Graham Bell. And I just sort of stumbled upon this small story of him trying to help find the bullet in Garfield by inventing something called an induction balance. And it really surprised me because, first of all, I'd never heard the story before. And secondly, I wondered why Bell would do this. You know, Bell was at the height of his fame and his power at this point in his life. He was only 34. He had invented the telephone just 5 years earlier. And he turned his life upside down to try to help Garfield. And it made me wonder, who was Garfield? What was he like? And started researching him and was amazed. He was this extraordinary man who has been largely forgotten.
And the story, it, as I said, really does have everything to it, right? It's a great story.
Thank you very much. The more I get into it, I was just surprised again and again and again by all these incredible characters, this unbelievable story, and I was just sucked in right away.
You know, after you finished River of Doubt, which was this largely little-known story about Teddy Roosevelt's perilous journey down a tributary of the Amazon, how worried were you that you'd be hard-pressed to come up with another topic of, you know, similar caliber?
Very worried.
Yeah.
I had so much with that that book. I obviously had Theodore Roosevelt, and there are people who will read anything about Theodore Roosevelt. I will read almost anything about Theodore Roosevelt. And I had the Amazon, and I had murder and drowning and Roosevelt's near suicide. And I had all these primary sources. And what I've learned is that, you know, you've got to hold out for the right idea. And what goes along with finding the right idea is finding a story that has a lot of primary sources. So you can really have that rich detail and hopefully make the story move. And I absolutely had that with Destiny of the Republic.
Well, people will wonder, 130 years ago, when you mentioned primary sources, what kind of material is out there that enabled you to pull together this story?
Well, first of all, since it was a presidential assassination, and because he didn't die right away, you know, he lived for more than 2 months. As you might imagine, newspaper reporters covered it from every conceivable angle. So there are all these fascinating, almost too many newspaper stories. There were so many to go through. It was this wealth of material. Also, you know, although Garfield was only in the presidential office for 4 months before he was shot, he was in Congress for 17 years, and he was an incredibly prolific writer and an incredibly accomplished speaker. And so there's a lot of primary source material to work with, diaries, letters. It was fantastic.
Mm. You know, I heard you say once, Candace, that you became so attached to this man, James Garfield, that in the course of researching him, that you actually got teary writing about his death. What was it about Garfield that affected you so much?
Well, first of all, what people don't know is he was extraordinarily brilliant. You know, he was born into incredible poverty. You know, he's the last president to be born in a log cabin. I mean, literally had oiled paper for windows. His father died before he was 2 years old. So to put himself through college, his first year, he was a janitor and carpenter. By his second year, they made him professor of literature, mathematics, and ancient languages.
Because?
because he was so extraordinary. He was just – he was incredibly gifted, very smart, and he was passionate about learning and was his whole life, certainly throughout Congress while he was president. He was a university president by the time he was 26. He knew – he was an incredible classicist. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. While he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem. He was just off the charts brilliant. But more than that is his decency. You know, he was just a good, kind, honest man who was trying to do the right thing.
What was his childhood like? You know, I'm thinking he's being raised in a log cabin. His father dies before he's 2 years old. What was that like, and how did his mother handle all that?
It was extreme poverty. You know, he didn't have a pair of shoes until he was 4 years old, and this is in Ohio, if you can imagine the winters there. And his extended family thought that his mother should send out – he had a brother and two sisters – that they should send out the children to be raised by other families because she just couldn't afford it. But she was determined to keep the family together. And she also taught her children to never be ashamed of their poverty. And Garfield never was. You know, he said – we shouldn't celebrate poverty, especially when it comes to children. But he was never ashamed of it, and he always walked with his shoulders squared and his head put back. And he learned that from his mother, who was a very proud woman. In fact, she had to sell most of their land after the father's death, but she left a portion of it that she gave to the community so the local children could have a school.
You know, he died fewer than, 15 years after the end of the Civil War. And what was interesting to me was he was respected by both the North and South at such a crucial time in our history. What did his death do to that very tenuous reconciliation process, Candace? And why was he one of the few men respected by both North and South?
Well, I think because he was, you know, he had come from this extraordinary background, and he was considered one of their own to all of the American people, you know, North and South, freed slave, former slave owner, pioneer, certainly as his parents have been pioneer immigrants who saw in his incredible rise sort of hope for themselves and their children and justification for their sacrifices. And so although he was one of their own, he had you know, climbed to these incredible heights. And so they trusted him and loved him. In the South, you know, he had been a huge hero in the Civil War as a Union general. And he had been a fierce abolitionist his whole life. And in fact, had been instrumental in bringing about black suffrage. But he approached the South as a problem of education and not looking for vengeance, but looking for help for them and a way to unify the country, again, through education, he believed was the answer.
So very much in the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, it sounds like.
Absolutely. You know, I always think of Garfield as sort of having the mind of Thomas Jefferson and the heart of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. Pretty good characteristics,
Candace. Not a bad
Candace.
Combination.
He was president for such a short time. Why would anybody want to kill him?
Well, the man who shot him, Charles Guiteau, was a deeply and dangerously deranged, delusional man who saw in Garfield's incredible he was nominated under this unusual, surprising turn of events, and he saw it as an opportunity for himself. And when he didn't get what he was wanting to be made ambassador to France. He had what he believed was a divine inspiration.
There's no reason why he should be ambassador to France. He was just nuts, right?
That's right. No, he had Charles Guiteau had tried everything, and he had failed at everything. He was really the mirror opposite of Garfield. They had both come from difficult backgrounds. But while Garfield had had success after success, Guiteau had had incredible failure. He had tried law. He had tried evangelism. He had even tried a free love commune, and he had failed even there. The women in the commune had nicknamed him Charles Get Out. But he continued to have these delusions of grandeur. And yes, he believed that that Garfield would make him ambassador to France.
And he stalked the president.
He did.
Over,
you know,
and over again.
It's like a Hitchcock movie. It's so creepy and so terrifying. You know, he after Garfield's election, Guiteau went to the White House and the State Department every day asking and expecting this incredible appointment. And in fact, at one point, he even walked into the president's office while Garfield was in it. He was able to get that close to him.
In those days, you would think, you know, again, so few years had passed since Lincoln had been murdered that there would be such a thing as a Secret Service to protect the president. But what was the reality there?
That's right. So this is just 16 years after Abraham Lincoln's assassination, but there's still no Secret Service protection for the president. In fact, Garfield had only an aging police officer and his 23-year-old private secretary between him and the public.
Why was that, given the fact that Lincoln had been murdered?
Lincoln's assassination was seen as a result of war, and the American people believed that they should have access to their president. You know, there are a lot of assassinations going on in Europe, but they thought that that was a result of the monarchy, of these leaders being forced on those people. The American public were able to choose their leader for themselves, and so they thought, so there should not be any anger or resentment toward the president, so no danger to him. And they didn't want any barrier between them and their president. And Garfield was expected to have office hours every day from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., meeting with the public, these people who expected government positions, wanted to make their case directly to the president himself, and they did.
So the Civil War is over. Peace is returned to the land. No reason to think the president should be threatened in any way.
That's right. In fact, Garfield himself said that assassination can no more be guarded against than death by lightning, and it's best not to worry about either.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUY. We're visiting today with Leewood author Candace Millard about her new book, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. It's a multifaceted story, a very intriguing story about the murder of James Garfield back in 1881, our president at the time. You know, Charles Guiteau, the assassin of James Garfield, nearly met an early end himself, Candace, prior to shooting the president. How close did he come to his own premature death?
So Charles Guiteau, after Garfield's nomination, decides that he's going to go to New York to campaign for Garfield and will single-handedly make Garfield president. And so he gets on a steamship, and it's night, and it's incredibly – there's this deep, deep fog, and they can't see anything. And he's on the deck, and he can't see his hand in front of his face. And suddenly the steamship crashes into another steamship. It's actually its sister steamship. And the other steamship explodes in flames, and it sinks, and more than 30 people end up dying. And they're able to get the survivors back to land. And and everyone is so grateful that they've survived. But Guiteau sees this not as luck, but as God personally choosing him, saving him, because he has some, you know, great idea, some great plan for Guiteau.
So why didn't somebody stop him? You know, famous, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. Why didn't somebody stop Charles Guiteau and sort of put an end to what he was up to?
You know, this couldn't happen today because this is a time in American history when there's a lot of play in the joints, and no one sort of understood what he was up to and could call him to account for it. You know, he lived this very solitary, very peripatetic existence, moving from city to city, boarding house to boarding house, leaving whenever the rent was due. He traveled all over the country by train, never buying a ticket. And his family knew that he was mentally ill and had actually tried to have him institutionalized years earlier, but he had just slipped away. And he absolutely should have been. I had gotten help long before he was a danger to the president.
Let's turn to the assassination itself. I mean, the fateful event took place at the train station in Buffalo. How did everyone happen to be there on that day? James Garfield, Charles Guiteau. How did the event come off?
So Guiteau had been stalking the president for weeks after he had had what he believed was a divine inspiration, God telling him to kill the president. You know, he had followed him all around the streets of Washington. In fact, one night, Garfield left the White House, walked down the street to his Secretary of State's house. Together, they walked alone through the streets of Washington, Guiteau following them the entire way, holding a loaded gun. Mm. He followed him to church. He followed him to a different train station. And finally, he decides, the next opportunity I have, I will shoot the president. And so he reads that Garfield's going on a trip. It's part work, part family vacation. He's there with his two older sons, with his Secretary of State, also his Secretary of War, who was Robert Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's only surviving son, and a couple of other cabinet members. And when he arrives at this train station, Guiteau is waiting. And, of course, Garfield has no protection. And Guiteau just steps out of the shadow and shoots Garfield twice, once in the arm and once in the back.
So he shoots him from behind.
He does, immediately. I mean,
At close range.
And the first bullet goes through his arm. The second bullet rips into his back. But amazingly, it doesn't hit any vital organ, doesn't hit his spinal cord. It goes to the left and goes behind his pancreas. And at that point, it's done the damage it's going to do. Unfortunately, Garfield's doctors end up causing much, much more damage.
So if James Garfield had been shot today, no question he would have been saved and his presidency would have continued.
Absolutely. His injuries were less severe than Ronald Reagan's were when he was shot.
What was the scene at the train station like in the moments after this? How did the country react? How did people react at that moment?
Well, in the train station was absolutely chaos and terror, as you can imagine. You know, Garfield, his legs buckled. He was this very tall, vigorously healthy, handsome man. He was wearing this wonderful gray summer suit, and he just begins to vomit, and there's blood everywhere, and everyone's screaming. And the first reaction is to catch this man who's caught Guiteau, and Guiteau is nearly hanged right there. They have to really save Guiteau from the mob, and he's taken directly to a police station, and he's thrilled. He's so excited that this has happened, and he's
that he's done the deed.
Yes, and
he's lived up to his promise and everything else.
And he knows he's going to get a lot of attention. You know, his particular brand of madness, this delusion, sort of fed off attention, and so he's very happy. The country is devastated, shocked, and devastated, and enraged, and demanding justice.
How about Garfield's own sons? How old were they at the time?
So his older sons were teenagers, and they're with him. And as you can imagine, it was horrifying. I mean, they're just plunged into this nightmare and trying to keep people away from their father on this train station floor, where he is examined by a doctor on the floor of the train station, probing this wound in his back, if you can imagine.
With his fingers.
Germ-infested environment. With his fingers, straight off the street, probably has manure on his hands, you know. And it's just this horror. His two younger sons were actually on a train on their way from Washington to their home in Ohio. Garfield had a farmhouse, and they were going to spend the summer there. This is July. And it's this incredible, heartbreaking story. You know, the entire country wanted to protect these two boys because they were alone, and they didn't want them to find out what had happened to their father while they're alone on this train. And so station by station on the train itself, people are saying, don't talk about the assassination. If you can imagine,
because word has spread so quickly by telegraph and everything else.
Absolutely, by telegraph and even early telephone and just word of mouth, station to station, they're protecting these boys, and they actually make it all the way to Ohio where their family get them and take them to this farmhouse without finding out. The country sort of rallied around to protect these boys.
And hadn't those boys just been playing with their father that morning before they went to the train station?
That had actually been the older boys.
The older boys.
He had gone into their bedroom and sort of singing with them and doing somersaults and things. He was a very devoted and attentive father, and his children loved him deeply.
I can see why you got so emotionally attached to him. Sounds like an amazing man.
It's interesting because The River of Doubt was difficult to write logistically, you know, going to this very remote river, finding this tribe that had haunted Roosevelt's expedition. This story was difficult emotionally because I did come to care about him. I think it would be difficult not to, and I worked on it for 3 years. And reading, you know, his wife's diary and his children's diaries in the Library of Congress. And so when it finally came to the point when I had to write his death scene, you know, this has been several years I've been working on it. And, I remember calling my husband in tears saying, I don't, it feels like I'm making this happen. It's been 130 years since his death, but it just to write it made it feel so real, and it's such a tragedy.
Was there any question in your mind as you were working on this that a book about a president who's so lost to history would prove to be compelling enough that people would want to pick it up and buy it? even today?
Well, I didn't know, but it was compelling.
You never know,
to
do
me.
You?
You never know. And but it was compelling to me. And as a writer, that's really important, especially if you're going to spend many years on a subject. You know, you have to be caught up in it. You have to care. You have to want to think about it all the time, every day. And I think if you don't, your reader certainly won't.
Well, at least he was such a likable man. It's someone you'd want to think about a lot.
That's right. It's somebody, you know, I admired. And I, you know, I hope that if people do read this book, that they will learn who this man was. You know, even at the time, Americans understood that he would probably be forgotten. And that was one of the heartbreaking things to them. You know, they is not only that his presidency would be forgotten, but that he as a man, the person he was, would no longer be understood. You know, there are all these sort of photographs and portraits of him, and his wife hated them because she said they never captured who he was. You know, he had this sparkling eyes. He'd give you a bear hug before a handshake. You know, this big booming laugh. He loved life. He loved people, and he cared deeply about people. And the idea that that would be forgotten was heartbreaking to the American people.
Were you able to read Mrs. Garfield's actual diary? Do you actually hold it in your hand when you're researching a book like this? And what did she write about these days after the shooting?
You know, she didn't write in her diary about it. She wrote in her diary about earlier things. Her children wrote about it. Molly Garfield, his daughter, his only surviving daughter, who was 14 at that time, her story, she was so angry and so devastated by his death, and she wanted Guiteau to pay. And I remember she writes at one point after her father has died, she said, you know, I know Papa is in a better place and I should take comfort in that, but oh, I miss him so. And, you know, as a daughter of a wonderful father, I completely understand. And as a mother, I completely understood that. And it was heartbreaking. Lucretia Garfield was extraordinary in that she kept all of her letters with Garfield. You know, they were apart so much in their early marriage because he was fighting in the Civil War or he was away in Congress while she was in Ohio. And the early years of their marriage were very difficult. And there were some painful letters. And she kept all of them because even though no one else was sure what his legacy would be, she was. She understood who he was. And she kept them all. In fact, she started the first presidential library in their home after his death.
Well, let's take a break, Candace. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Candace Millard about her newest book, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. It's number 7 on the New York Times upcoming bestseller list. It's another hot seller for Candace Millard. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the doctors who killed the president and the race against time that Alexander Graham Bell was up against. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour, we're talking with Candace Millard about her new book, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. It involves the incredible story of James Garfield, his assassination back in 1881. You know, Candace, James Garfield was never supposed to be president to begin with. He didn't really go after the job, which is so unusual compared to the candidates these days. So how did it work out that he actually became the president of this country?
That's right. Garfield used to say that he never had presidential fever, as so many people around him did.
And do you believe it?
I do absolutely believe it. In fact, he never ran for any office. He didn't campaign. People would ask him to run, and he would. He would serve in the position, but he always said that he was going to follow his own conscience and convictions, and if people didn't agree, they shouldn't vote for him.
What a concept.
He was elected again and again. And so at the 1880 Republican Convention, Garfield was there to nominate another man. He wasn't a candidate. He didn't want to be one. So it was in this huge hall in Chicago, 15,000 people. The favorite to win by far was Ulysses S. Grant, who was trying for a third term in the White House. And so Garfield's gets up to give his speech, and it's incredibly noisy and raucous.
It's for someone else besides Grant, right?
For John Sherman, who was William Tecumseh Sherman's younger brother and Secretary of Treasury under Hayes, and who was also from Ohio and was nervous about Garfield because he was so popular and thought, okay, he'll give my nominating speech and it'll be clear who the candidate is. Unfortunately for Sherman, Garfield was a very gifted speaker, and he begins to speak, and the hall immediately goes quiet, and all you can hear is Garfield. And people are just riveted. And it's this beautiful speech, and it was so powerful and so eloquent that at one point he says, "And so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want?" And someone shouts, "We want Garfield!" And the entire hall goes crazy. And so when the balloting begins, delegates start casting their ballot for Garfield. And he tries to stop it. He objects, but the votes keep coming. And it just grows and grows and grows until he finds himself the Republican nominee for president of the United States.
And who did he run against for the presidency?
He ran against a man named Hancock. He was nicknamed Hancock the Superb. He was also a hero in the Civil War. Had very, very little political experience. And Garfield won.
What happened to Ulysses S. Grant?
Grant was humiliated and angry, and he never really forgave Garfield for it, and sort of avoided talking to him. But when Garfield is shot, he comes to see Lucretia and is very moved and upset by what has happened.
Does Grant write about that in his very famous memoirs that have been so highly revered over the years?
He does a little bit. He mentions it briefly, but this was, sort of a footnote to him. I mean, he had such an incredible career of his own.
Well, let's turn to the doctors and the race to save James Garfield, because the story really gets interesting now, as if it hasn't been interesting enough already. Who are Garfield's doctors, Candace?
His principal doctor was a man named Dr. Willard Bliss. His
first name literally doctor.
Was doctor.
Yeah.
And you can't make this stuff up. And Robert Todd Lincoln actually sent for Bliss when he's at the train station after the shooting, because Bliss had been one of the doctors at Lincoln's father's deathbed. And he comes and he just takes over. He's incredibly confident, incredibly arrogant, and he sees in this national tragedy an opportunity for fame and power. And he probes Garfield's wound again and again there in the train station, the small room they had taken him to. He and several of the doctors, there are nine doctors at the train station by this time, go to the White House with the president. Bliss very quickly makes it clear that he's going to take charge of the president's medical care. He dismisses the other doctors, dictates a letter to them saying, the president, I thank you for your help, but it will no longer be necessary, even though he's never had that conversation with Garfield or the First Lady.
I was going to say, what made him think that he could assume control like that?
He was just a uniquely arrogant and confident man. And, he just took advantage of what is, of course, incredible fear and chaos surrounding a presidential shooting. And so no one knows what to do. It's completely shocking and unexpected. And he steps forward, and he's well known, he's well respected. And so everyone sort of, and they think that this is what Garfield wants. And so they step aside.
So these doctors are sticking their fingers into the bullet holes in Garfield's back. Should they have known better at that point in the history of modern American medicine? Should they have known better than to have been doing something as sort of clumsy as that?
That's the worst part of the story for me.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
What makes it so sickening is, you think, well, they didn't understand what they were doing at that time, but they did. They absolutely should have known better. Joseph Lister had discovered and introduced antisepsis 16 years earlier.
Yeah.
He had had dramatic results in his own surgical ward in England. It had been widely accepted in Europe. He had come to the United States begging American doctors to sterilize their hands and instruments and warning them that if they didn't, they ran the very real risk of killing their patients. So Bliss knew about antisepsis. He chose not to follow it.
And why not?
He was very worried about the president's care. The last thing he wanted to do, ironically, was to let the president die. And so he thought this was sort of new and untested, and he was going to use some very most traditional medical methods of the time. And
those methods were what?
Well, the doctors at that time, first of all, Bliss gave Garfield, a gunshot victim, rich foods and alcohol, morphine, quinine. He sort of reveled in and publicly exulted in what he called the healthy pus issuing from Garfield's wounds. And he
meaning that healthy pus is a good sign.
They believed some doctors and certainly Bliss at that time believed that pus was a good sign. You know, doctors talked about the good old surgical stink. They wouldn't change or wash their surgical aprons because they thought the more blood and pus encrusted on them, the more experience it showed. And even those doctors who tried antisepsis failed for reasons that seem so apparent today. They would sterilize their surgical knives, but if they dropped them during surgery, they would just pick them up and continue to use them. If they needed both hands, they would hold the knife in their teeth and then continue to use it.
Man. You mentioned that they fed Garfield a lot of food, even though he's ailing in extraordinary pain. What was the thinking there?
You know, they were just trying to keep him strong. They thought they would keep him strong because he was obviously weakened by the gunshot.
Could he keep the food down?
He didn't. He vomited again and again and again uncontrollably. In fact, what happened to him in the long run is that not only was he dying of this unbelievable infection. He was also starving to death. He went from 210 pounds in July to 130 pounds in September, so by the time of his death. So he was starving to death. They tried all these different ways to give him nourishment, but he was also suffering from severe dehydration because he had lost so much blood. They were giving him alcohol, and they weren't giving him enough fluids.
So as you look at all this, I mean, what is your own judgment on these doctors who didn't use the right techniques? I mean, what do you think looking back? Did they mean well or did they blow it?
Both. I think they were wanted more than anyone, really, besides maybe Garfield's own family.
They wanted
to
save him.
They wanted to save him. And you know, Bliss worked night and day. He was so worried that he controlled everything surrounding the president's care. Even at first he had people taking his temperature, and he took over even those menial tasks because he was so concerned. He wrote to a friend on White House stationery, "I can't afford to have him die," underlining each separate word. He had too much at stake. But really his own sort of willful ignorance and arrogance led to the president's death, and not just his death, but the torture of the president. Yeah. You know, he had so much infection in him. He had an abscess that was half a foot in diameter near his liver. He had infection-induced pneumonia in both lungs. He had an abscess on his face that paralyzed his face and then ruptured and filled his mouth and nasal passages with so much pus and nearly drowned him.
Man. And to what extent was he aware of what was going on? Was he conscious? Was he talking to his wife and communicating?
He was absolutely conscious the whole time. He was very, very weak. He couldn't sit up. His wife had to read to him. But he was very aware of what was happening. In fact, one of the last things he wrote was "Strangulatus pro Republicus," tortured for the Republic. But what he was worried about was everyone else. You know, he hated all the worry and strain that this was causing. And he, you know, every time his doctors would come in, he would shake their hand and thank them. And he would make jokes. He was always this sort of, you know, very funny guy, but never at anyone's expense. He was just trying to relieve some of the concern and worry for those people around him.
You know, in the history of American medicine, Candace, are there other examples of doctors sort of making such a gross set of mistakes as happened here?
I'm not aware of any example. I'm sure there are many, but any example as extreme as this. I mean, if you think about it, this was taking place inside the White House,
yeah,
you know,
right.
with the entire nation, really the entire world watching and hoping and praying. And they had hope, you know, because at first they believed that Garfield would die right away because Bliss believed that the bullet had gone into his liver. And then he survived and he got stronger and stronger and stronger because his body was fighting off that initial infection until finally it couldn't fight it off any longer because it was introduced day after day after day. So it's just incredible to think that this was happening inside the White House and no one understood really what was going on.
We're talking about the assassination of James Garfield with Candace Millard of Leewood. Her newest book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. David from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I was just wondering if I'm remembering my history correctly. Wasn't he shot at the World's Fair?
He was shot at the Baltimore and Potomac train station, which was on the National Mall in D.C. It's actually where the National Gallery of Art stands today. And it was a very controversial station because it was on the mall. There are actually tracks on the mall, and trains would regularly jump the tracks and maim and even kill people. And in fact, Garfield himself, while he was in Congress, had argued to have it torn down. A lot of, you know, it's just considered a blight on this beautiful section of the Capitol. And interestingly, Theodore Roosevelt is the president who had the station raised many years later while he was in the presidency.
Well, if I'm remembering my history right, and I may be incorrect about which president it is, but I was under the impression that somewhere nearby the shooting there was a display of some new technology called the X-ray, but the doctors didn't realize the value of it.
They
didn't know how to use it.
I believe that was McKinley's assassination 20 years later. The medical X-ray wasn't invented until 14 years after Garfield's death. Had they had it, they would have known that the bullet wasn't a danger to him. And this is where Alexander Graham Bell comes in with his invention, the induction balance, which was basically like a metal detector and trying to find the bullet.
So I have the history right, just the wrong president.
I believe so.
All right.
Thank you.
David, thank you. Well, let's turn to this other amazing side story here, Candace, about the push to save Garfield's life with this new invention that you just mentioned. And the key player here was a man that we all know, Alexander Graham Bell. And yes, it's the same Alexander Graham Bell who is credited with inventing the first practical telephone. How did he get involved with this whole process of saving the president?
So Bell is only 35 years old, and he just wants to help people. You know, he had lost both of his brothers to tuberculosis before he was 24. Both his mother and his wife were deaf. And he knows that he can make life better for people, maybe even save lives. And he's sick of the telephone. In fact, he's just quit the Bell Telephone Company because he hates this big company that's grown up around his invention. There are 600 lawsuits against it, and he's just had enough. And so he's quit the Bell Telephone Company to everyone's shock and horror, and he has this little laboratory in D.C. And when he hears about the shooting, he knows he can help. You know, it sickens him, too, at that time, to think of these doctors blindly searching for this bullet, and he thinks science should be able to do better than that.
And so what does he do?
So he remembers that years earlier he had invented something called an induction balance to basically get rid of the static in the telephone line. And he remembers that it was also a metal detector. And so he starts to work on it, and he contacts Bliss. And Bliss by this time is desperate and agrees to let him secretly, without letting the public know, come to the White House. And
So Bliss knows who Alexander Graham Bell is.
Everybody knows.
Does.
And really, Bell is taking a chance because he has more of a reputation to lose than Bliss or anyone, you know. And everybody, word gets out that he's working on this invention to try to find the bullet in Garfield's back. And there are articles and people are sort of watching, and they know that he's feverishly working in his laboratory night and day. And he finally perfects this induction balance. He makes it in this sort of mobile form and has a deep range to it, and it absolutely works. But he, too, is defeated by the president's own doctors.
And what happens here? This story just takes your breath away.
So he goes to the White House. The doctors fail to tell him, first of all, that that Garfield is lying on something that's very new at that time, which is a mattress of metal coils. And, of course, that's going to affect a metal detector. And then also Bliss believes and has publicly stated that the bullet is on the right side of the president's body, and he'll only let Bell search the right side of Garfield's body.
Because Bliss is certain it's on the right side.
He's certain, and he doesn't want to be found wrong. And he also, you know, they test and test, and Garfield's getting tired. And so he finally says, there was a little peep of something. And he says, that's it. That must be it. I was right. It's on the right side. Thank you very much, Alexander Graham Bell. And asks him to leave. And Bell knows. He knows that that's not right. And he's frustrated, and he continues to work on it. But unfortunately, what Bell doesn't understand is that he's not racing against time. He's racing against the president's own doctors who are introducing this infection into him.
And it turns out that the bullet is on the left side.
It's on the left side. And they find that out during the autopsy. Garfield's doctors are there, and they realize right away, first of all, the passage that they thought was the bullet's track they've been probing all these months, they realize they themselves had been making that with their tools and fingers, and it's been filled with pus. And the bullet didn't hit anywhere near the lever, and it's on the left side, and they realize what they've done wrong. More than that, the American people, when the autopsy result is released, they understand that the president didn't have to die, and they understand why he did.
And so what was Alexander Graham Bell's reaction to this, and how did Dr. Bliss react to the news that the bullet wasn't where he was so certain it was?
Bell is sickened. You know, he believes that, first of all, you know, he saw this, you know, wonderful man with so much promise who died this agonizing death, and it sickens him. But two, he thinks, you know, he knows that his invention works and that it can help people, and he thinks no one will want to try it now that it didn't work on the president. But he's wrong about that. The invention goes on to save countless lives, and, you know, the Boer War and the Sino-Japanese War before the invention of the medical X-ray. Bliss refuses to admit that he's done anything
wrong. Of course
wrong.
Not.
He insists that he not only gave adequate care to the president, but exemplary care. And in fact, he hands Congress a huge bill for his work, his services, and Congress refuses to pay it and gives him only a fraction of it.
Is that
right? Bliss dies not many years after this.
His reputation when he dies, Candace, is what? After all of this? I mean, it's amazing to hear you describe this, because you're talking and you hear the bullets on the left side instead of the right side. It's frustrating to me 130 years later. I just can't believe it.
I agree. You know, I kept wanting to shout, stop, somebody stop these men.
Wake up.
But Bliss is disgraced. There are many articles in newspapers and a lot in medical journals, sort of vilifying him for what he has done. You know, there were doctors. In fact, interestingly, there was a doctor from Kansas who wrote to Lucretia Garfield, the first lady, telling her, don't let them probe the wound. Make sure they sterilize everything. Uh-huh. And there were young doctors who had studied the Listerian method in Europe, but they didn't feel like they could question these very respected and experienced doctors. And a doctor from, you know, rural Kansas is just not going to be heard.
Alexander Graham Bell, what was his reaction to where the bullet was found? Do we know?
Yes, he was horrified. He writes to his wife, now
said,
I understand why it didn't work, because I didn't search any area of the body where the bullet was, and that's why. And it just sickens him. You know, he's also going through a personal tragedy at this time. His wife, while he's working feverishly in D.C., his wife is in Boston with her two daughters and her parents, and she's pregnant. And she gives birth to a child. He comes back quickly. It's the baby's born too soon and can't breathe and dies after just a few hours. And Bell once again approaches this tragedy with a desire for science to fix it. And he invents something called a vacuum jacket, which is a precursor to the iron lung.
Mark from Olathe writes this, Candace, does Garfield remind you of any people alive today, any current political figures that have similar characteristics?
You know, I think Garfield is really unique, and here's why. Because he didn't have, as he said, presidential fever, and because, you know, I think today it's very difficult to find a candidate who doesn't want to be a candidate, right, and hasn't sacrificed really everything to get where he is. And so Garfield was really unique in that he was absolutely his own man, mm-hmm. because he hadn't wanted this feverishly, and because he hadn't made any deals with anybody, and because he understood himself and his own beliefs and his own ideals and stuck to them, you know, through all these years in Congress, his friends used to marvel that Congress didn't change him. And this is during the most ruthless and vicious era of machine politics. And he never changed. And he was always his own man. And he was always confident in that. And I think that really makes him unique.
You wonder what the press would have done with the one fact out of Garfield's life that might have raised questions. It regards his marriage. What happened there?
So Garfield and his wife are very different people. You know, he was this very outgoing, passionate person, passionate mm-hmm. in his education, passionate in his dealings with people. You know, he loved life. His wife was very smart, but she was very quiet and reserved. And Garfield really, he was frustrated. He wanted more from her. And they were apart so much. They were apart for they were only together for 5 months during the first 5 years of their marriage. And at one point, he had an affair. He fell in love with a young widow in New York. She was a journalist. And he thought that this was his one chance for love. But he decided that he would rather be respected and be able to respect himself than be loved. And so he comes home and he confesses the affair to Lucretia, and he thinks, you know, she's going to lose all respect for me. Instead, what happens is that he falls in love with his wife. Slowly over time, he sees that she's not cold and distant, but she is strong and wise. And it's this incredible story. I mean, he falls so deeply in love with her. I mean, the letters he wrote to her were so soaringly beautiful. And they're this incredibly devoted and passionate team, you know, and she understands him and he understands her. And it's one of the real tragedies of the story. He was only 49 years old when he died. And she lived a long life without him and missing him every day.
He's buried where?
He is buried in the Lakeview Cemetery in Ohio, in Cleveland, Ohio. It's a beautiful, moving monument to him, and he's buried with his wife.
Let's go to Michael from Garfield, Kansas. Michael, good morning.
Yes, there's a monument outside of Garfield that is of a pyramid, and I think I've came across where he was interested in Destiny of the Ages through the pyramid chronology. Do you know anything about his interest in that subject?
I don't know anything, but I'm not surprised by it. You know, he had an incredibly broad and deep knowledge of many of the classics, and so I haven't seen that. I'd love to see it. I'm glad to know about it.
Michael, where is Garfield, Kansas?
Oh, it's close to Larned, Great Bend, that area.
And it's named after the president, obviously.
It's along the Santa Fe Trail, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a little monument outside of town of a pyramid.
I'm glad you called, Michael.
It's pretty close to midpoint on the Santa Fe Trail.
Right. Thanks for the phone call, Michael. I appreciate it. And Candace, always good to have you again. What a great story. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it. Thanks, Steve.
That's Candace Millard. Her newest book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. We spoke with her in October. You'll find more information about Candace and all of our guests, as well as previous broadcasts and podcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Join us tomorrow for a conversation about the history and future of America's manned space program. And Brian McTavish returns with our special New Year's Weekend to-do list. We had help today from KCUR's Danny Alexander and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.